to my hometown of Edinburgh to be invited to speak when I actually have a view of the John McIntyre Centre, named after my dissertation supervisor, the late, great John McIntyre, and to be invited to speak on my birthday. And so there are... In fact, I could go on being delighted for 45 minutes, and we would do very well. It's a treat to be here. I want to thank John Bryant and Caroline Berry, who are old friends, for ensuring that I came, because it's been a fascinating long weekend we have had, even if the more typical Edinburgh weather has finally caught up with us. I've lived in the United States now for 16 years, and so when I'm in Britain, I try to pronounce things the British way, so my British friends don't know. And my American friends, when I'm in Britain, well, we won't go there. You may know that one of the fundamental distinctions between our two great nations, and I have two passports, so I can play these games both ways, is that Americans know that the Brits spell words differently. What most Americans don't know is that Brits know that Americans spell words wrong. And in that quip, an awful lot is summed up. This section of the program is called bioethics. Now, ethics is a strange thing. If you talk about ethics as such, people fall asleep rather rapidly. And yet, most of the time, we are actually talking about ethical questions. And when you talk about questions raised which have ethical implications, people wake up rapidly. For those who teach ethics, you know exactly what I mean. You call your course, you know, Ethics for the New Millennium or something like that, nobody comes. You know, you list some of the questions and the room is packed. And I think it is interesting to note the way in which, in conference planning, we will have a section called bioethics, as if bioethics is not simply a footnote, but essentially a sort of hard case chapter or an appendix to the main discussion of the questions of knowledge and society in which we engage. And at one level, that, of course, is true, because bioethics has become a kind of dumping ground for hard questions. And given that hard questions play well with the press, it's also become something of a dumping ground for academics who like getting their name from the newspapers. I mean, there's been a whole series of interesting movements over the last 30 years. And those who do or don't appreciate the irony, which comes through in my rather British way of putting things, well, you've no excuse if you're a Brit. I'd like to lay out what I see as the emerging broad agenda, which has been labeled as a bioethics agenda, but seems to me to be something which is fundamentally different. The questions being raised by the emerging technologies of our day have given rise to particular discussions of questions in bioethics, and I'll talk about one or two of them in particular. But this has had the effect of distracting us from the fundamental significance of the potential developments in these technologies, not simply for hard cases and narrow issues and contested values, but for the most fundamental question which we could confront, which, of course, is the integrity and the dignity of human being. And so, I mean, I will touch upon areas on which some of you are expert and on which I am not, a series of areas. And I think part of the key to what we need to do is to join the dots and put the pieces together and see the significance of these individual developments, which those who are bench scientists or who are teaching in universities often professionally are not required to do and find it hard to do. Christians, more than anyone else, have a rationale for taking an interdisciplinary and global approach to our view of knowledge and the interrelation of its different components. And, of course, we are those who were responsible, more than anyone, for the development of the medieval university with its common vision for knowledge. And we are those who, more than anyone, should be distressed with the breakup of that vision and with the way in which our universities were developing into what some have called multiversities and other terms. And, of course, we now find ourselves in a situation where there is great premium to be placed, not least in many grant contexts, on building interdisciplinary collaborations as we fight back into the mainstream tradition of Western thought and try to put the pieces together. And so if we engage in discussions about particular technologies, what seems to me to be beyond a peradventure is that we are engaging in discussions about anthropology. Because this is, homo faber, man the maker. This is us fulfilling our destiny as laid out there in Genesis chapter 1, to subdue the earth and engage in the stewardly responsibility for the development of the natural order under God. And it is us doing so in ways which increasingly are reflexive, which increasingly have either a sort of blowback or a direct intent of affecting human being in itself and the nature of the human community. And these are questions, it seems to me, in which people like us should be in the forefront. And should be in the forefront not simply in developing a distinctively Christian critique of certain of these developments, though that is something which is open to us, but in working side by side with persons of conscience and goodwill in developing a public critique and a public frame of reference within which these developments should be assessed, and ultimately, of course, framed in issues of policy, which is ultimately, if you like, the flip side to ethics. I mean, essentially all issues of policy within the democracies are intended to capture the values which are shared by the electorate. This is basic political theory. And properly done, democracy captures our values, and they become the basis for policy. So it is around these interrelated questions that I want to talk this afternoon. I elected not to PowerPoint you. For those who are having sort of addiction withdrawal issues, that is your problem. There have, of course, been a lot of discussion of the PowerPointing of knowledge and its pluses and minuses, and I made an election not to wear a tie, which seemed to me, for a Presbyterian back in his home city of Edinburgh, was on the verge of scandal, but I shall get away with it, and John has given me cover, because he doesn't even have a jacket.
I have no cover, therefore.
One of the themes of what I'll say this afternoon is the significance of the development of what is called transhumanism. And I think the role of the transhumanists is of considerable value in the way in which we engage in these discussions, because as so often, those who are ideologically in a strong and extreme, maybe a word that's unfair, but certainly a position which is intended to be consistent and highly critical of other attitudes, can perform a very great service to everybody else by clarifying what the questions are. Doesn't mean to say one buys all of their analysis, let alone their agenda. Neither does it mean to say one wants to give them undue prominence. But prominence they have, and in their crystallizing the potential significance of the convergence of emerging technologies, they have, of course, been in the prime position. And I myself have engaged in many dialogues with leading transhumanists, and in fact, a book which is not on the book table, although I handed out some flyers, which I have edited, which John Wiley are publishing sometime this month, which is called Nanoscale, basically as a collection of essays looking at the societal implications of emerging technologies, and we have two very prominent transhumanists writing for the book. I think they're very good debate partners. But it does seem to me that the transhumanists and their most astringent critics, Luddism is something people, those who are their mirror image, who are most suspicious and most ready to be critical of the potentials of technology, have in fact a very similar analysis of the potential of these technologies. And I think they feed off each other in the way in which the ideological debate has begun to run. One of my concerns about that particular debate is it has been a debate taking place largely sub rosa. That is to say, it isn't a secret discussion, but it's not been a discussion which has been given a formal place at the center of our policy discussions for science and technology. Neither has it had a central place in our discussions about the nature of the human community. It has tended to take place in ways that have been hard to define and hard to bring under public scrutiny, and I think particularly in the United States, but I think also in other jurisdictions, the transhumanists have made considerable progress in instantiating some of their fundamental assumptions about the purpose of technology and about the nature of human existence. In policy contexts, in civil service contexts, which will be hard to dislodge, partly because of the lack of public debate and democratic accountability for the discussions of technology policy, over which they have begun to exercise considerable influence. Now, I want to say I'm not demonizing the transhumanists. I think to an extent they demonize themselves. I think much of what they regard as transhumanism I would just regard as proper applications of new technologies. And they are, of course, very ready to push those of us who have been critical of them in public into a corner. I had the, I think, unique honor, I hope it is unique in my life, of featuring on a PowerPoint slide, put up in a conference in the United States on bioethics and policy, by perhaps the most prominent, certainly the most vigorous American transhumanist. I was coupled with Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber, which seemed to me to be a peculiar kind of honor, and it is the case, and you may or may not know this, that Ted Kaczynski's writings are actually extremely smart, and they have penetrated to the heart of many of these discussions about technology policy. But let's not go there, because the association is not good. But my point is that there is a sort of ding-dong which can easily be set up in these discussions, in which transhumanists say technology is wonderful, it's going to enable us to be post-human ultimately, and to enable us to master the human condition and extend the human condition and its capacities and augment us, and this is wonderful and it's a liberty issue, and the only people who disagree with us are the Luddites who want us to go back and live in caves. And there's a tendency for those on the other end, not acknowledging the cave and Luddite associations, to say, well, all of these developments are going to be transhuman in character, and we've got to close down the technologies. And I think that there is a very significant strategic need for the mapping out of middle ground in this discussion, to hold at bay what seem to be unhelpful and hyperbolic ideological approaches, not least in order that we might have democratic accountability for technology policy and ensure that, the GMO story, genetically modified food story, however one wants to couch it, whatever side one happens to be on if one is taking sides, but to ensure that does not become the pattern in which we have technologies being developed and then essentially insurgent controversies taking place which seek to dislodge them. This is not a good pattern for the future of democracy and technology. And if we believe, and I think this would be taken as read by certainly many of those here, that the 21st century will be dominated by, to predict, in terms of the sort of scenario planning people get involved with, for those who take that view, the caution we tail GMOs, of course, is the point at which to begin. I want to move aside to make a comment about a particular, as we prepare for the controversies to come. And that is the controversy about cloning for research, or so-called therapeutic cloning, to use the increasingly discredited marketing term which has been used, and indeed which has been used and withdrawn from by many of its advocates now because of its confusing and conclusionary nature. But of course here we are in the United Kingdom, which has been the sort of global leader in pressing the adoption of this particular technology, pressing it in a way which has had no serious political opposition, and pressing it in a way which has had pretty profound effects around the world, because the UK, for all of its diminished current status, intersects with most other nations in a series of contexts which give it enormous diplomatic leverage and certainly provide enormous cover for those in other jurisdictions who are seeking support for positions that they wish to advance. I won't talk at length about cloning. I mean, I was invited to say something about the embryo as part of my presentation, and I'm not going to get into the fundamental embryo discussion, except to say that it seems to me that it is a strange claim that which I heard actually put in those terms, or should not be regarded as having a kind of presumptive claim on membership in our species and our moral community. I think it's a strange claim. But I think it's a different claim to the claim one needs to make if one is looking at somatic cell nuclear transfer. Here we are just down the road from the place where it, of course, originated in Dollyland, and the kind of policy discussions which have erupted around the world, the epiphany of the sheep. Well, there are at least three Anglicans here. Somatic cell nuclear transfer, as applied to human beings, which, of course, is held out by some in the scientific community and certainly by the government of this country as being of enormous potential significance and something which is entirely ethically to be accepted, is a very serious criminal offence in many other jurisdictions. And whereas both in the UK and in the US, where it is not against the law in federal law, although in some states it is, this process is often regarded as controversial because it's a pro-life issue. And I think these debates have suffered on both sides of the Atlantic from that conceptualization. And, I mean, the facts which may or may not be of interest are that if you go to France or Canada, France, I think, being accepted as the largest secular country in the world, and Canada as the most socially liberal of all large countries, both of them would send you to prison for engaging in research in human embryo cloning. I would advise you, if you wish to do it, in Germany, where they know a thing or two about unethical science. It has been a serious offence now for almost 20 years. In Switzerland, home of the European drug industry, it's a crime. And as some of you may know, the United Nations General Assembly, in the press in the UK or the US, which was the summation of a four-year diplomatic initiative, very complex initiative. I just wrote a lengthy law review article about this. For those who really want it, you can email me and get it. That's something to look forward to. In which all forms of human cloning. And this was specifically understood to include therapeutic research cloning, not least because the United Kingdom's permanent representative, in his rather disdainful speech to the General Assembly itself, made it clear that that was his government's interpretation of the declaration. And indeed, if you read the many thousands of pages of debate that preceded it, that was indeed the interpretation being placed upon this language by the participants. And it brought together a very curious collection of developing nations and the United States and conservative Catholic-type countries and a number of players whom you might not have expected. And Germany, having initially pushed for a focused ban on so-called reproductive cloning, and the Germans and French who initiated this entire process, it's a very instructive process, Germany was forced by domestic opposition to its position under Chancellor Schröder to abandon its sponsorship of its own approach, to break with France, and finally to join the other approach in calling for a comprehensive cloning ban, which was in line, of course, with its domestic legislation. But I lay this out because it does seem to me that it is a matter of scandal that there is so little awareness of these discussions, particularly here in the UK, also to a degree in the US, the discussions taking place around the world on these highly contentious, fundamental issues of ethics and public policy. And my own position on these issues is clear, but the point I'm making now is not to commend my position, but to commend the significance of these discussions and the sort of nuancing and fresh understanding of the issues which an awareness of the global discussion can bring. Of course, as things stand at present, this is a different discussion from the discussion about the use of embryonic stem cell research. And most of these countries which have prohibited cloning for research permit and often fund the use of supernumerary embryos for research. So the framing of this issue as an all-or-nothing pro-life type issue within the two sides of the Atlantic represented here has, I think, been highly unfortunate and has somewhat troubled me as I look ahead at how we shall handle these other issues of emerging technology, which I think ultimately will have far more significance. Because I see the cloning discussion as a sort of footnote to 20th century technology and its debates. I will be very surprised in 30 years' time if researchers are going to want to use human embryos for research. At least people I know working on synthetic biology have other plans. And the rapidity with which change is taking place in the life sciences, as well as in engineering, is so great that it seems to me this will not be the issue in a generation's time. What will those issues be is becoming increasingly clear. Let me say a further word about the technology anthropology question. Because it seems to me the significance of this whole clutch of technologies, whether you want to talk about advances in reproductive technology, which is the last generation's contribution, or whether we're speaking about artificial intelligence, particularly the brain-machine interface, the notion of, you know, of implants to enhance human intelligence, that whole collection of sort of robotic and enhancement questions, whether one is speaking about the development of neuropharmaceuticals, which presentation very interestingly illumined for us yesterday in one of the parallel sessions, the notion that you can basically create ultimately a private universe, the Soma universe of Huxley, the lotus eaters of Tennyson, in which drugs essentially give you the universe you want. So you basically go post-human, but you go post-human that way, rather than by having actually to change the environment and your capacities in the outer world. The link-up of these technologies, both inner and outer, with developments in virtual reality, and of course you can begin with Second Life, which has been an absolutely fascinating story, laying out there how VR is going to begin to have the same kind of impact, even using current technologies that, you know, Facebook and MySpace have had on young people particularly. And now we have major corporations using islands on Second Life for training purposes. And I heard recently of a woman who was raped on Second Life.
Oh,
if you aren't into Second Life and avatars and virtual reality, go Google it, you know, when you go home. And had to have counseling. And I actually was with someone in the UK quite recently who is a very distinguished expert in artificial intelligence. And we were just chatting about this, and I won't quote him by name, private discussion, but he said, well, you know, he said, I was asked to go on Second Life to do a presentation, some sort of lecture or something, which was being set up by an anybody. I went along, and my avatar was there, jumping around. And he said, you know, there was a photographer there. You know, this was, again, on the screen, for those who aren't into all this stuff, taking pictures of us, the students, and on the group, the avatar, and so on. And he said, and this really very attractive young woman, avatar, sort of came up to me and said, can I have my picture taken with you? And, you know, and he said, I really felt very good about this. And then I realized what was going on. I mean, the power of VR has yet to begun to be explored. Then, of course, you tie this up with the brain-machine interface, the fact, you know, there are now venture capitalists putting money into video game manufacturers who want to use skull caps to control the cursor. I mean, this is not just basic science, this is now development, it's now commercial funding. And so you have a whole set of it. And then, of course, you have the fundamental transhuman agenda for the augmentation of the human mind and the human body. And you have the risk introduced from a business point of view, from a policy point of view, by the branding of these technologies as transhuman. Now, I'll say a little about the American debate here, because that will warm the hearts of the Brits, who tend to be pretty anti-American these days, as I know, and probably of many of the Americans too, in that the National Science Foundation has, I think, in a way which is highly unfortunate, been the occasion for the publication of a whole series of essentially transhumanist manifestos, which I think have seriously raised the risk profile of these emerging technologies on the nanoscale by giving them a branding which places them on the sci-fi side of public understanding and is setting up these technologies for a GMO-type reaction. And for those who want to pursue these things, I'm sure we have enthusiasts here who have pursued them, maybe have people here who think that what the NSF has done is wonderful. Well, you're welcome to think that. We can't all be right. The fundamental volume here was one published called Converging Technologies for Enhancing Human Performance, published back in the early 2000s. On nanobio infocogno. They came up with this tetragrammaton, the four letters NBIC. And this enhancing human performance, improving performance language, has been somewhat doused thanks to some response which this produced. But they produced now four or five of these books, essentially on the same theme, and essentially publishing material which frames the technologies in transformative terms and is, I think every one of these books has had two or three chapters written by people who are transhumanists in their byline. And they've all been co-edited by a very distinguished American science administrator called Bill Bainbridge, William Sims Bainbridge. I mean, this is not a secret conversation. He is, I think he is co-director of human-centered computing at the National Science Foundation. He's the editor of a two-volume encyclopedia of cybernetics. Some of you will know his name professionally. He's a most delightful man, a Renaissance scholar. He writes sociology of religion at an academic level in his spare time. And Bill Bainbridge has co-edited each one of these books. And Bill Bainbridge is on record as being a card-carrying transhumanist. And the story goes that the European Commission read the first of these books. And because the book is called a report, now what's a report? But because partly the word report was then followed by a lengthy executive summary at the beginning of the book. When you publish conference papers, you don't usually do an executive summary. They regarded this as a policy document coming out from the United States government. And they then convened a high-level expert group, which, for those who don't know, is Eurospeak, for a commission of inquiry of senior experts, which produced, I think, 7 different documents in response, one of which was a final report. And using language like that, the American approach is not that these technologies converge with each other, it's that these technologies enable us to converge the human and the machine. And if I actually have a chapter outlining this in the book that I published, but I also was able to get a presentation into one of these conferences on converging technologies, where I sat there with the assembled directors of the National Science Foundation in the front pew and told them this story. Now, the point I want to make, with several points coming out of this, the key point is that the transhumanist infiltration into the policy process is well advanced. I was asked to testify to the European Group on Ethics, which, as you may know, is the advisory group on ethical issues in science and new technologies, to the Commission, a couple of years ago, on nanotechnology and American discussions of its social implications, and I did so, and I said some of this. And I said I wanted to, I wasn't an official representative of anybody, but I said, you need to know, this is not an official US document. This was a misinterpretation. This was a mistake. This is just a bunch of people who put papers together for a conference. And I actually just last month got an email from someone doing a research project for the commission expressing astonishment that I could have said this. Because he'd reread all the documents and he said, this is plainly an official report. So I give you that story. I mean, I'm obviously seeking to give you sort of core samples of a much wider discussion that we can get into this afternoon. But I want to alert you to the policy dimension of these questions and the, I think, enormous damage that can be done by the branding of these technologies by the transhumanists. And that is partly the function of the fact that there is so little actual policy discussion going on in the middle ground about the future of these emerging technologies, which have within them the capacity to reshape human nature itself. Now, 1 or 2 conclusions, and then we'll leave a few minutes for some Q&A. Seems to me that we have to find a way to raise the profile of the policy discussion about science and technology within the democracies. And that is of enormous importance. Now, things are, of course, going on. I don't doubt some of you are on various advisory panels and take part in official discussions. A very useful occasion has been a series of meetings between the US and the European Commission, or hosted by them, called Perspectives on the Future of Science and Technology, which I took part in a year ago in Italy. But these are, I mean, who heard of that? I mean, these occasions take place, but there's no public platform, there's no actual engagement of the media in these conversations. And some of you will know that UNESCO includes, the UNESCO structure includes the World Commission on the Ethics of Science and Technology, or COMEST, which is its French acronym. And they recently produced a book, in fact, on the ethical and policy issues in nanotechnology. It came out just a month or two ago. So I'm not saying that there's nothing going on, but it seems to me whatever is going on is grossly out of proportion to what needs to go on if there's to be a major proportionate discussion within democratic societies of the purpose of these technologies and what they're going to be enabled to do. My view is that the controversies about stem cells, cloning, and GMOs are just pinpricks in comparison with the kind of assault which we will face within our societies when these emerging technologies begin to come on stream and have commercial and policy applications. You could raise many others. Look at privacy issues. I see that the police in Britain now want to take DNA from you at a traffic stop, and no one seems to be worried about it. Britain really is the place where all these technologies and their applications are being pioneered in the way which, well, when I had the one occasion in my life I was invited to write for the Guardian newspaper, two or three years ago, in a sort of point-counterpoint with Robin Lovell Badge. And for those who don't know, who was the head of all these things at the MRC, I think, Medical Research Council, very nice man. And I said that I thought the central principle of British approach to policy on these technologies was insouciance, which I thought was somewhat rude, but it made the point. I mean, no one is looking at these questions and talking about their significance. And whereas I have no doubt at all that the global warming discussion, which is, of course, a vast discussion in which we have been engaged here, is going to have profound consequences for the future of the globe, the future of the species itself, which these technologies are now putting on the table, is a matter of at least equal consequence. Two levels of response are needed from us, it seems to me. We have to have a Christian response, not least a response within the churches. Because just as now people are coming along to you after church and saying, is it okay to have a surrogate baby, you know, or is it okay to have this particular kind of PGD or whatever it is, pastor, you know, by the way, or we just did this last week, that was okay, because you never talk about these things in the pulpit. I mean, we are now having technology issues to be faced in the next generation, which are of far greater consequence, even than these questions. And for leadership, but also for coherent reflection. I mean, what is good and bad? I mean, I'm working with the idea of a word like hyperhumanism as a way to focus on the transformative proprieties in the application of these technologies to enable us to be more human. One problem with the transhumanists is that they have to have an interest in being human in the first place. So I say to them, you've got to go back to the Renaissance first. You go back to the Renaissance, then you go to the Enlightenment. Don't worry about the Bible. Just go to the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, and then come back and tell me what you want to add. Because it seems to me the question is much more enabling us to be who we are made to be, and using technologies to enable function of many kinds to be restored, and it may be to be augmented, but within the metaphor, within the analogy of Homo sapiens in the image of God, before you ever get on to ways to improve. One of the phrases memorably used in this US report was that one possibility was we would become one great interconnected world brain, aka the Borg, and one of the results of this would be what they actually call in this report, using the phrase, world peace. Well, I think it was the Roman who said they make a desert and they call it peace. These questions should be center stage in our Christian thinking. And then secondly, I think we have an opportunity to play a crucial part in catalyzing and framing these questions in the broader arena. And just as an example, some of you may know about this, but I'm presently putting together an initiative to develop a think tank in Washington, D.C. on science and technology policy. There is no freestanding think tank in Washington. Of course, U.S. controls 3/4 of global R&D in pretty much all these technologies. There's no freestanding think tank on S&T policy in Washington. There isn't really one in London. I mean, Ian Gibson, some of you will know, Member of Parliament, has set up Newton's Apple, partly to try and fulfill this gap. And he and I have talked about these things. We're friends. But, I mean, there's no conversation going. We've got to find a way to have the conversation. And so what I'm looking to do is to set up the Center for Policy on Emerging Technologies in Washington and to have a global network attached to it with a transatlantic dialogue and some components in Asia. So that, not least, I mean, people like us can get around the table. And I have people joining in with this from left, right, center, all over the place. And once you get into these emerging issues, people of goodwill, who like the Enlightenment and like the Renaissance, are going to sit down with us and have a common conversation about how to frame the meaning of these technologies and their application in a way which is for the human good and also which helps manage business risk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nigel, very much. I'm going to claim chair's privilege here and ask the first question. In relation to the technologies you've been talking about?
No.
All right.
I mean, I... Uh-huh.